This episode is brought to you by SD Sober Living. If you or someone you know needs a safe and supportive recovery home, then reach out to SD Sober Living at www.sdsoberliving.org or call 619-625-0769. That's 619-625-0769. Come get some San Diego recovery and some fuck fentanyl at SD Sober Living.
No longer fear the unknown, cause I know what I am here for. I keep on trotting on my own path, keep on learning from my present and past, yeah. When I no longer need validation, cause my story is long and I'm patient. I know that I have lessons to learn, keep my eyes open each step I earn, yeah. No need for me to feel alone, cause I got a place that I call home. Every single road travel, every single new place, I come back home, they accept me with grace, yeah. When I know that I was meant to be here, and I know that I was born into fear, but I will stand tall in the lion's den, cause I know in my heart I am one of them. That there lies in the facets of everything that we see.
Welcome to the Fuck Fentanyl Podcast. I'm Luis Romero. I'm the Fuck Fentanyl guy. And today, I got a really special guest. I have my friend Sage. How are you doing, Sage?
Hi, Luis. I'm doing great. Thanks for inviting me.
Nice. I'm feeling irie after listening to that.
It's a great song, right?
Let's see here. Wow. Well, Sage is one of my friends, but Sage, honestly... is like one of the women I really, really, really like look up to and like and really respect. She does so much for the recovery community here in San Diego. And I have gotten pieces of her story from her shares, and you know, she's definitely been through a lot, and I would love it if you could share it with my audience today.
Sure. You want me to start at the beginning?
Start it off beginning, from birth.
Okay, great. Well, I was born into a dope house.
Nice.
Yeah, you know, my mom was an addict, and, you know, my father was very abusive. And my mother had me, she would give me alcohol when I was 6 months old, you know?
Oh, wow.
And not like to, you know, numb the gums, like, you know, they used to say, you know, you give it to numb the gums. Yeah. But she would do it to shut me up, you know, and put me out. And so... you know, that kind of was like the trajectory, right? Like I learned from a really early age that how I was feeling wasn't okay, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's kind of the theme of my childhood, you know? And my father started smoking weed with me when I was 2 years old. You know, he had me rolling joints by the time I was 5.
Shit, you
I swear to God, I swear to God, yeah.
Damn.
Yeah, you know, and, you know, I would see his, he would leave, you know, his, you know, half of joints in the ashtray, and I was allowed to just grab them and light them up whenever I wanted to. And,
wow.
You know, and so, you know, I started really early. That was the only life that I knew,
mm-hmm.
you know, my father was very abusive and, you know, he wasn't so much like my mother was a junkie, you know, she was an addict, like,
okay.
And so she would take off for, you know, a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And my father, he was actually my stepdad. He married my mom when I was 2 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, he stayed angry all the time because he was with my mom, probably, you know, and she would run off and be, you know, doing what she does, what addicts do best. Right.
Right.
And he was left with me. And so I think I got the brunt of that a lot. You know, and
he was frustrated.
He was frustrated, you know, and you know, I was told to be quiet and not talk, you know. So my disease first manifested really for me in like fantasy, where I would like go into my room, you know, alone, and I would have this fantasy about, you know, whatever it was, you know, and the love and life, you know, being better than it was, you know. I always wanted something better and more, you know. And I remember, you know, it's funny because I was just doing some deep core work yesterday, and I was remembering the moments, you know, of my childhood, some more moments. And there was this moment where I remember thinking, you know, why did you have me if you couldn't love me, you know?
Yeah.
And like I didn't ask to be here.
Yeah.
And that core wound just kind of stuck with me, you know? And, you know, anyway, and so that's kind of the theme of what happened for me, you know, is that. And yeah, so anyway, from like the young age, you know, I couldn't see that my father's violence at the time was, you know, justified. You know, all I knew is that he was the mean guy, my mom was gone, and I blamed him. I blamed him because she would, as you know, as an addict, of course, used him as an excuse to run away, you know, so I would blame him. But really, you know, it's like they both were just, you know, where they were at. But I would chase my mom and chase her love, you know, and try, and she could do no wrong in my eyes. Mm-hmm. Like, no matter what happened, I held her on a pedestal. You know, okay. And my father in my mind was this monster, you know, and we just didn't get along. He was my nemesis. And, know, yeah. And so.
Was he like a disciplinarian and all that?
Yeah. Well, he was very violent, you know, and yeah. he was abusive and he was a disciplinarian. But, you know, it's like, you know, I just like, you know, I remember even just spilling milk in the kitchen, you know, and he just came unglued at me spilling milk, you know? And like, and so from that moment, I was so afraid to like spill anything that like I would literally shake going in the kitchen and and I would always spill something, you know? So like I would always get it, you know?
Yeah.
And so like just growing up in that kind of, I don't want to say traumatic environment, you know what I mean?
Of course,
it really does like put stuff, you know, it instills you with certain things that, you know, that you know, just that feeling of never being good enough.
Yeah.
That feeling of like there's something wrong with me, like I'm broken, you know? And so, you know, like many of us feel that way, you know, as I've come to discover is like we all share that. You know, just never feeling like we fit in, never feeling good enough, you know? And that was definitely my story, you know? And I met my sister. I was 10 years old and she was 13 and she was a street kid. And I met her and she was this cool kid that like was popular and, you know, and I wanted to be just like her, you know? And so I ended up bringing her home and I asked if we could keep her and we ended up adopting her.
Wow.
And, and she was my sister, you know, and with her, I got to do all the things, you know, and I started using, you know, cocaine. I think my first time using, I was 10 years old, you know, in the drinking, you know, we started with the drinking and the cocaine. And, you know, and one day I was looking for change out of my mom's purse and I came across her, because I was a thief from an early age.
Oh, wow.
So I used to go into their into their stuff so I could get change.
Right.
Go buy candy because I was a food addict big time, you know. And anyway, so I was going in her purse to find some change for the vending machines. Yeah. And I opened up what I thought was a change purse and it was a paraphernalia kit, right?
Oh,
and I opened it up and there was like vial of meth. And there was there was a gold spoon that said Foxy Lady on it.
Foxy Lady. Yeah. Wow.
You know, and the gold tutor and it was like fancy. And the friend that I had with me, she had done meth before, right? Because I kind of like gravitated towards the knuckleheads, you know?
Yeah.
From an early
age. She was cool. She had already done it. And
So she showed me how. So she took the spoon and she put it in the vial and she snorted it, you know?
Uh-huh.
And so I followed suit and I took a big old rock and snorted it, not knowing. And like, it was so painful. But I was like, I fell in love, you know, immediately. Yeah. That was the beginning for me. And I would steal her meth for many years for a year and a half.
Would she notice?
She thought it was her dope dealer shorting her. Yeah, she thought it was her dope dealer shorting her. And so, you know, it's so funny, you know, she finally figured it out, you know, and and then she realized that I was using, you know, and it's crazy. And, you know, my sister and I were both using. And for me, you know, I still had to go to school and I still had to do the stuff, but she got away with everything, like, because she wasn't the real kid.
Mm-hmm.
So they let her stay home. They let her, you know, they took her shopping and stuff. And like for me, I had to, you know, they, and I see that they were trying to instill value in me, I guess, or, you know, character, you know, because they would make me work for any money that I got, you know, and like doing dishes for whatever, you know, money. But she got to be taking shopping and all this. So I, in my head, for someone that, that felt like, for someone who already felt like she was unloved, that just proved to me more that like, oh, you love her more, right? Oh. Or I'm not loved. And so,
it's kind of like Cinderella in a way.
Yeah, was, you know, and I get where they're coming from, where they were trying to come from now, you know. Yeah. But yeah, so, you know, I started to kind of resent her a little bit, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
But anyway, so, you know, moving forward, I want to talk about junior high school, right? Okay, so I never fit in. And because of that, like, I mean, I was the one that, like, just didn't fit in with anyone except for, you know, the drug addicts, you know? And so I would steal weed from my dad's stash and I would take it to school and, like, and share it with my friends, you know, that we would go ditch at lunchtime. And that's how I felt valuable. You know, I know that, like, I remember just being like really needy with love, you know, and I didn't know that at the time. I just knew that I wanted friends and I wanted to feel love, you know, and like I'm sure it came off as like needy. And so I was not popular, you know. And so that's where I found validation, is like being the one that had something that people wanted, you know. And in junior high school, I was bullied, you know, quite a bit. And one of the worst days of my life, I was graduating that 7th to 8th grade, right? And we all get up on stage to get your diploma, right? And it goes in alphabetical order. So I'm R, so I was near the end. And, you know, you get up, you get your diploma, you shake the principal's hand, and the whole school claps, and it's like amazing, right? I get up. And I had my best friend there from out of town, and my parents there and everything. I got up and I went to go grab my diploma and shake the principal's hand, and the whole school booed.
What? Oh my God, what?
Yeah. And my legs went out from under me and I couldn't breathe.
Oh my God.
You know, and so I was like wobbling, trying to get off that stage, you know, I was just shaking. And in that moment, in that day, like I literally snapped, right? Like I really see how people become, you know, like they become, you know, school shooters, you know, and go nuts and take it out on everyone. I see that because in that moment I snapped, you know. But what happened for me was, you know, I was kind of passive up until that point. And I had made a decision in me that no one was ever going to pick on me ever again, you know, and I set out to beat up everybody that ever picked on me. And I did that, you know, I became really violent, and violence became a huge coping skill for me throughout my life.
Well, I can imagine you're so hurt and embarrassed and you're just going to take it out on them, you know?
Yeah. You know, and so that's what happened. And somehow, you know, throughout hating those people, you know, I became those people, you know, it's like I became the bully, you know,
and that's usually like the cycle of how that all starts.
Yeah. And, you know, and so, you know, that took me all the places you would think it took me, you know. Anyway, I got kicked out of my house when I was 12 years old.
Okay.
It was that summer of that, you know, it kind of escalated all my acting out at that moment. Was like, just, you know, it hit the fan and
just angry.
I was angry, you know, and I tried to stab my stepdad, you know, and, you know, I had a lot of rage in me, a lot of rage and a lot of pain, and I didn't know what to do with it, you know? And so it was just coming out everywhere. And so my father kicked me out when I was 12 years old, and my mother had left him, you know, and she left me there. At that time, you know, I won't get into all that, but she left him and he kicked me out.
Okay.
And so, you know, I spent a lot of time, you know, on the streets, not, you know, at 12 years old, you know, I would like try and get a job, but they won't hire you.
Not at all.
I tried. I'm like, I lied. I'm like, they want you to have the work permit. And like, you know, I couldn't even finish school. I tried to get to school and I couldn't make it, you know? And so, so I house hopped from place to place and, you know, and nobody taught me about boys, you know, I didn't have like, I didn't have that kind of guidance, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I thought that, you know, that if I was with you, then you liked me, right? And so, like, you know, I ended up being very promiscuous and learning the hard way, you know, that that was not the way to go. And so that took me down that road. And, and yeah, you know, so it's just kind of like the beginning of my story and that just kind of like continues, you know, and escalates and gets more just like it does for most of us, you know.
Yeah.
I ended up, you know, doing a lot of jail time and a lot of prison time and, you know, and in the middle of that, you know, I met the love of my life and I actually met him when I was like 14 years old.
Oh, really?
But we
didn't. How old was he?
He was 3 years older than me.
Okay.
So I was 14, he was 3 years older than me, but all we did was like hold hands and you know, I met him then, but
and then when you guys were in a relationship, how old were you guys?
I was 22 when we started in our relationship.
Okay.
I skipped a lot of years because I'm going to tell you, like, on the streets, you know, all the things I gravitated to what I considered family, right? Like the first sense of family in my life. And I went to, you know, all the street kids and we, you know, and I learned that lifestyle and that was, you know, that it felt like home for me, you know? And so there was a lot of that, you know, but all the things that you can imagine, right? It's like, they all went with that. And, you know, and, I became a stripper. You know, because my mom was a stripper and
you know, it was good money.
And a hooker and she was a porn star, you know?
Oh,
so I know.
Did it all.
Yeah. She did all that. And so, you know, I knew the owner and that was the, like where she worked. That was the first place I went to go get a job, you know? And so that was part of my story. And, anyway, so I ended up getting together with the love of my life when I was 22 years old. Yeah. And for the first time in my life, you know, I met someone that loved me unconditionally. You know, I had never experienced unconditional love before, you know, not from my mom, not from my father. I'd never experienced that, you know, and it was amazing. And I truly am grateful to him for showing me, what that feels like and that I'm worth loving, because up until that moment, I didn't even know it, you know? Yeah. So he gave me, you know, that beginning of, you know, self-love, you know, just realizing that I was worth it. And, but, you know, many years later is how, you know, that it grew, right? Yeah. So anyway, you know, I ended up going to prison again. We had gotten married. I was 23 years old. And, and while I was in, he got more time and we kind of spent time like that back and forth.
Oh, you and him were both in that prison while you're married.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, and he got out, you know, after I waited for him, you know, I waited for him 7 years in prison.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And,
so, you waited 7 years for your husband to get out of prison. And, what happened after that?
Well, I actually kind of want to go back.
Okay.
A little bit.
Let's go.
You know, I feel like, I missed a huge chunk of my story in this, you know, and that's you know, like before my husband, right?
Uh-huh.
It's like I got validation from men, right?
Okay.
And like many of us do. But that's like the only place where I felt valuable or self-worth or any type of love. It's like if you wanted me, you know, then I was valuable, you know? And so, of course, I became a stripper, you know?
Yeah.
Because that really did give me that sense of value, that sense of I matter, you know,
the instant gratification.
Right. Exactly. And so that was a huge drug for me. Like that was huge for me. Like that was probably one of my biggest addictions with men, you know, and that validation that I got because I was so empty and so, I was so empty, you know, I just had this huge void and that's the only place I felt valuable, you know? And so I did that, and I set out to like be the best stripper, and you know, and
that's right,
you know, and like, but that's because like I wanted to be just like when I was younger, you know, and I had what somebody wanted, you know, so I got the weed so that they would like me. It's like if I was the best and I made the most money and I, you know, ended up becoming the manager of the strip clubs, which I did, right?
Oh, right on.
then you know, then I would be needed. I would be valued. You know, I would matter, you know, and so it really did like play. I was constantly just trying to fill this hole, you know, and with outside validation.
Yeah.
And so that was a huge part for me, you know. And my husband, I think, was the first authentic, you know, relationship where it's like I just felt seen for me, you know, and unconditionally loved. And I'm so grateful for that. So I wanted to share that a little bit. Before I talk about, you know, the rest of the story.
Of course.
You know, and that's that. So anyway, so I waited for I went to prison, I got out, and my husband had went in by the time I was out. He couldn't handle life without me. So, you know, it wasn't the healthiest relationships because we were still very codependent on each other.
I think
we resonated with each other's trauma, you know? But we loved each other unconditionally. It felt like home, you know? And so anyway, so he was in prison and I waited for him. And during this time, I was going to try and get clean. And so my mother, she had actually gotten clean when I was 17 years old.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And she tried to bring me to my first NA meeting.
Oh, she tried when you were 17?
Yes. And I looked around and I was like, oh, God. Back then, you guys did bowling for fun.
Oh, yay. Bowling.
So 17 years old and bowling on Tuesdays just did not seem like fun
really?
To me.
Oh, I did it. Bowling with clean and sober people on a Tuesday. A 17-year-old wouldn't want to do that.
You know, and it was a bunch of old people because back then there wasn't the young population that there is now.
Yeah, I see exactly what you mean.
Yeah, and so I was like, these are a bunch of squares and a bunch of losers, and this is good for you. You need it.
Yeah,
you know?
You need it.
I don't need this. And so, you know, it didn't.
You're ready to be a stripper. And
right, exactly. Exactly, you know, and honestly, I had this this victim mentality where it's like, you made me like this, you know? Mm. You made me like this, you know, trying to be a mom now and show me the way at 17 years old is a bit late, you know?
I can see that.
So it didn't stick.
I could definitely see that.
Yeah, so it didn't stick, you know? And so so at this time, though, you know, the seed did get planted. And so at this time, when he got out, when he was in.
Yeah.
And I decided that, like, I was going to, you know, hold it down and I was going to get clean and I was going to go to meetings. And that way when he got out, you know, we would be able to have that happy life that, you know, and that we wanted. And so I tried that and I got 3 years clean.
Oh, wow.
And
how old were you at this time?
I was 26.
Oh, wow. So you were pretty young still.
Yeah. Well, I was 26 when I got out of prison. Uh-huh. And so that's when I went into recovery, you know, and then, and I can tell you about the times before, because actually there was a lot. I went into recovery a couple times, you know.
A few times.
Yeah.
But this one was kind of the one that kind of stuck.
This was the one that began to stick, you know. And so, so I decided I was going to try and do this program, you know, this 12-step program. And see if it worked for me. And I did it, but I did it kind of surface level. I still was like, I had so much guilt and shame at all the stuff that I had done. There was so many things that, like, you know, they talk about our yets, right? Like, like we talk about all the things. Yeah. Well, I'm not that bad. You know, I'm not that bad. I'll never be like you. And I remember thinking that about my mom and about my dad and, you know, and I ended up going to all those places, you know, I ended up being the violent guy like my father. And I ended up being the stripper hooker like my mother, you know, I ended up doing all those things. And as a result of that, I carried a lot of guilt and shame, you know, and I didn't like myself. And because I didn't like myself, I had to put on this facade of who I thought you wanted me to be so that I could be loved, you know? And so I was not fully willing to be honest, you know, when I did that first round of steps.
Yeah.
And so everything was kind of surface level, and I left out some very important things.
Resentments like that, some stuff like that.
The resentments I was able to deal with. It was more about the guilt and shame, you know, the areas that like I wanted to keep hidden forever. I didn't want anyone to know, you know, that I had done these things.
I see.
You know, and because if they did, they wouldn't see me anymore. They wouldn't like me. They wouldn't love me. You know, so I held secrets and I didn't, and you know, I didn't catch it then. I do now, you know, but like then, you know, our readings say the only thing that it's indispensable are honesty, open-mindedness and willingness. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that honesty in our book, without that, there is no hope. There's no hope. And I didn't hear that part. You know, I never really got that. I understand that now. We have to have that 100% honesty. So, you know, I did end up getting 3 years clean. I had surface level recovery.
Surface level. Okay.
Yeah. And I didn't heal. You know, I didn't have the freedom that everybody talked about. I did learn how to be a responsible person, you know,
I
got a house and all that stuff. Ooh. But like I didn't know how to heal what was going on inside. And my sponsor, I had put her on this pedestal. And when she did something that I viewed as betrayed me, I let that take me out. And I left the rooms.
Really?
And I said, you know what? I'm going to try and do this on my own. And I did that kind of successfully for like 7 years. You can call it successfully, right? It's like it was successfully for the fact that I didn't use drugs, you know, but I definitely continued to use men and money became my primary addiction.
Yes.
You were
filling the hole with all those things instead of drugs.
Right.
That void.
Yeah. But inside I was still that same wounded, you know, very, very closed person, you know, and I didn't have any freedom. And so as a result of that, you know, my husband got out prison finally, and you know, and things were not the same anymore. Like he, you know, I had done some things while he was in there because, of course, I was, you know, I needed validation, and so, so you know, I did the things that a wife probably shouldn't do, you know, and and as a result, we lost some trust, and that was one of the things that we always had was we always told each other everything, you know, and So when he got out, the dynamic changed a little bit, you know, and he was more, you know, looking through my drawers and that kind of stuff. You know, and so we had argued a lot, and he ended up relapsing, you know, a couple years later.
Okay. So he was clean while he was in prison?
He was clean. Yeah. He had 7.5 years clean.
Wow.
And he ended up relapsing, you know, and I kicked him out. I was like, oh, that's it. You know, you're using, you're gone. And, he slept with one of my friends.
Oh, Jesus.
Which was like the big no-no. That was the one thing.
Wow.
Yes. And that was the one thing that we had this commitment that we would never sleep with anybody's friends or anybody's friends, you know, and he did that. And so me, I was like this righteously indignant person, and, you know, and I was like, no, you guys are perfect for each other. And I didn't want him to come back home, you know? And I just held that, you know, I was stubborn. I was very stubborn, you know, and knowing the whole time that like, there's nobody else that I would want to grow old with. Like I loved him, you know, I just got in my own way. I didn't know how to heal things. And the pain inside of me, you know, ran the show for everything in my life. You know, and so like that's one thing that it ran the show on. And I ended up dating this other guy, you know, who I had known since we were kids. And he ended up wanting to do heroin.
And
I had done that, you know, throughout my life, you know, many times. However, I didn't like it because when you're on meth and you do heroin, sometimes there's a little reaction that happens. Uh-huh. I had that reaction and I would just fall asleep and puke for like 3 days straight. But being the good addict that I am, I would keep trying it.
I'll get it.
I was like, this is horrible. I hate this. Why do you guys do this? Yeah, I'll try it again. You know?
Oh my God.
And
you were determined.
I was, you know, I was determined. I'll try it again. It never stuck. But when I was clean for a while, and then you know, and then I tried it. So he did heroin, and I didn't want him to have to do it alone because of my codependency. Oh, I was like, I'll do it with you.
Oh, that's so nice of you.
So I did heroin, and then, you know, I fell in love with it. And and I saw why everybody wanted it, and everybody liked it, and, you know, we were close and lovey-dovey, and you know, and I thought it was just like that one time deal, and then a week later he wanted to do it again, and I was like, already, you know.
Oh, you really thought that he was just gonna do it that one time? And
yeah, I did. Well, I was very, you know, I didn't have a head full of recovery yet.
Sure,
I didn't have that experience, you know, and so. When he wanted to do it again, I was like, okay, just this time though, you know, and then we're breaking for a while. Right.
Yes,
and
yes, so, of course.
And so we did it, but that bag that we got, it lasted, 3 days. And I didn't know at that time that after 3 days,
physically addicted.
Yeah. Somebody that's had a habit in the past will catch another habit in 3 days. Myself, you know, if it's your first time, it might be 5 or 6 days. But if you've already had that, then 3 days. So he was sick, and he was kicking after 3 days. And and me being the good codependent that I am, I didn't want to see him kicking, so I got more, you know. And
oh, that's so nice.
I know, you know. And of course, I did it with him, right? So, you know, next thing I know, I have a habit, and I couldn't function anymore. I couldn't, you know. I was manager of a strip club, and I was doing parties. I managed girls on tour for oil wrestling. You know, I couldn't do any of it. The only thing I could do on the side was like little bachelor parties, you know, or like, you know, like extracurricular
stuff. Yeah.
And that's it. Like I couldn't work. And at that time.
So you were able to function to do all these, all your jobs before, but it wasn't until.
Well, I wasn't using.
I see.
It was men and money that was my addiction.
I see.
Yeah. I mean, and during that time, let me tell you, during that time of my addiction being men and money, it's like I became a loan officer. I bought properties. I was dealing in commodities. Like I was going after the big bucks.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And my bills alone, just in my own house, not counting the properties I had in Vegas, but my own house was $5,000 a month. Wow. So when I couldn't work and I couldn't function...
Yeah, it's gonna be a big bill to pay off.
It was a big bill, you know, and I ended up, you know, just going back to the life of crime that I grew up with, you know, and he was, you know, that guy, and we did that, and that's how I stayed afloat, and you know, and I would blame him. I blamed him for the fact that I was loaded. I blamed him for the fact that, you know, all of a sudden I can't work. Your job to make sure the bills are paid now, because you're the reason I'm like this.
Yeah.
That was kind of my pattern.
Of course.
I was a really good professional victim.
Oh, hey, me too. I convinced myself very, very well.
Yes. You know, and so, you know, and so that happened, and you know, we ended up doing a job, you know, a lick, and I didn't want to do this one because I just had this gut feeling, and also it was something that I just didn't, you know, want to do. But I did it because the good codependent that I am, you know.
Yeah.
So and that day, we got in trouble.
Okay.
And I got in a high speed chase, flipped the car.
Nice.
You know, and again, it was my second. Armed robbery.
Oh, okay.
And my second strike.
Okay.
And you know, and I ended up getting arrested and looking at a lot of time. At that time, I was looking like at, I don't know, 8 years, or something like that.
A good little stretch.
Good little stretch, you know. And then you know, and so I bailed out. He wasn't able to because he also had a record. And when I got home, my husband showed up on my doorstep, and he had found out from my mom what had happened.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he said, you don't know it, but you need me right now. And I'm not fucking going anywhere. And, and he fought for me, you know, and I think that's all I really wanted. Like, I just wanted to feel loved. You know how, like, you know, you get angry and like you push people away, but really all you want is a hug, you know, yeah. but you can't ask for a hug because pride and anger gets in the way, you know,
it does,
it's like, that was why we stayed separated, you know? And so when he did that, it was like, okay, you know, we got this. And, but I was using, and he had gotten clean again. And then, so of course he started using again with me. And
yes. Yes. That usually happens.
Yeah. And so, you know, it was rough. It was a rough time. And during that time, I'd been arrested while I was on bail, you know, quite a bit. I was going paralyzed. I found out that.
What?
Yeah. So I had, during all this time, it all happened all at once, right? Mm-hmm. So I had, I found out that I had a hold in my spinal cord. And, you know, it started, I thought I had carpal tunnel, but I ended up going to the doctor and getting an MRI, right? And finding out that I had a spot on my spinal cord that was so thin that if somebody bumped into me, I was going to be paralyzed from the neck down.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so crazy. I wouldn't have known that if you didn't ever share that.
Oh, you have no idea that side of my story. It's crazy.
Wow.
And, so yeah, so I went into emergency surgery, and my husband, he was with me for that, and he stayed in the hospital by my side in the hospital bed next to me, you know, for a week during that surgery. Uh-huh. And they, and when I got out, you know, he said, you know, he told me, I'm going to be there for you like you were for me, you know? And, I said, okay, but if I leave you with a habit, you won't, because that first time, remember what happened?
Yes.
He got loaded, he went to prison, and he was there when I got home, right? And so he said, well, if you keep using, you're not going to be, because you won't be able to be, you know? So he said, I'll get clean. Let's go get clean. And he's like, we'll go to my mom's house. And I was like, no, you need to get clean. I don't need to get clean.
Ooh.
You want to be there for me and prove to me that you love me, you know? And that's what I felt, you know, is like I still had this anger inside of me, and I was like, you know, you're going to suffer until I say uncle. You know, and I didn't know how to do it any other way. And I figured that's what love was, like they're willing to, if they really love you, you know, and it was totally, a skewed version of love, you know?
Yes.
And so, anyway, so, you know, he went to his mom's house to go get clean.
Okay.
And, he had 90 days clean, and I was out there, and, I was getting loaded. Mm-hmm. And I had gotten arrested again while I was out on bail.
Damn. You
know? Yes. And I had to go to court the next Monday. And I remember thinking, you know, I remember thinking, okay, well, I don't know if they're going to revoke my bail this time. It was like my second time getting arrested while I was out on bail. And
oh, Jesus. Oh.
Yeah. And so I told him I should probably see you this weekend. And so I called him. And I told him I should probably see you this weekend. And he's like, okay, I'm going to pick you up. I'll pick you up tomorrow and da da da, and you spend the weekend. And I was like, whoa, 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 you're not calling the show. I still was angry, you know? And like, you're not running anything.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm not going to see you both days. And mostly it was because I just wanted to stay high. And if I went with him for 2 days, then I couldn't do that, you know?
Yeah.
So I was like, I'll give you one day, not both days. And he got, you know, he got really hurt at that.
Yeah.
And we got in an argument, and he told me he was tired of feeling second best, and you know, and I was just a bitch, you know. I was a bitch. I just really was. I wanted him to suffer until I said uncle. And and anyway, as a result of that phone call, you know, he went and relapsed that night, and he died of a heroin overdose.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. And you know, it that completely devastated me. It cracked me open. And I can tell you that, like, you know, the 10 months after that, well, no, 10 months, maybe 8 months. I don't know. 8 months after that, was the darkest my life had ever been. And I tried to use so many drugs to cover up that pain. And there was no amount of drugs that can cover up that level of grief, you know, and self-loathing, you know, I had so much self-loathing from that.
Yeah.
And they had let me stay out that long because of the surgery that I had on my neck. It was so extensive that they were like, she needs a year to heal before, you know, going in. So they granted me that.
Oh,
and so,
no way.
So I was out on the streets for all this time.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, trying to kill myself, right, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, and I ended up getting arrested again.
Jeez, third time?
Yeah, you know, absolutely. Wow. I was a good addict. And so
made the most of it.
Yeah. And the, And it's funny, not funny, but funny, you know, that that I ended up getting arrested not in San Diego. I was in Vista, right?
Okay, Vista.
And not Vista, Orange County. I don't know why I said Vista. In Orange County. I was in Orange County. But the judge in San Diego told me on that last one, he said, make no mistake, Miss Robinson, you get arrested one more time while you're out on bail, I am giving you life in prison.
Oh.
And I got arrested again.
Pushing the envelope here.
Man, you know, and I had my husband's ashes in my car.
Oh, shit.
Next to me, I had his stack of memorials on the dashboard. I had all of his stuff in my car because I just couldn't part with leaving it yet. I was just this ball of grief, right?
Yeah, and they, sounds like it.
And they impounded my car with my husband, you know, and that hit me, you know, and I was in... So they arrested me again, and I'm sitting there, and I tried to bail out, and I had almost all the money, and they raised my bail to $1 million, and they were like, Jesus. You're not getting out.
Wow, they made a point.
They made a point, and you know, they weren't offering me a deal. They said prelim set for Monday, and I had the best attorney supposedly in the world, and and he was like, do you want to know what they're saying about you behind
it's not good,
it's not good, you know, and they want to give you life, you know, and they're not budging. They said that they don't want you free anymore, you're a menace to society, you know. Jeez. And you know, and it hit me, you know, that I could do life in prison.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, I was really erratic still, you know, everything, you know, the good professional victim that I was. Mm-hmm. And so I was, I went to the doctor because in that high speed chase where I flipped the car, my hands had went through the glass and I had glass coming out of my skin still, you know. And so they had sent me to the doctor to get that taken care of at the jail.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, of course.
And they asked me because I had a neck brace on from the surgery. I was like a mess.
Trying to play the part here.
Yeah, they're all, why are you here? And I just like, blah, you know, and they impounded my husband, and blah, 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 you know, and all this stuff. And they were like, I think you might benefit from some depression medication. And I was like, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Whatever you have, it'll make me feel better. You know, give me that, you know. And so, but I didn't know that came with a 72-hour psychiatric evaluation. So they stuck me in this room in what they call K-Mod, right? Where it's like everybody, all of the people that had mental health issues, you know? And there was screaming and singing, and I was like all alone. They took away my visits and my phone calls and my shower, and they just left me in there, and all I could do was either count the spots on the wall or... you know, or scream at my husband and God, you know?
Yeah.
And so I did that. And I finally surrendered to the pain for the first time in my life. And I did it kicking and screaming like a victim, you know?
Of course.
I was like, you want me to feel this effing pain? Fine, I'll feel it, you know? And like, if there really was a God, that's how I felt. You know, you're causing, like, my whole life has been suffering and da, 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 you know, and like, I didn't ask to be born and I didn't ask for any of this and, you know, and I'm a good person and all that stuff, you know? And so, but I finally surrendered to the pain in that moment and I grieved and, you know, that was the first time in my life that I had ever allowed myself to feel pain. Like, when I was younger, my father used to tell me, take it like a man, you know, I wasn't allowed to feel. And
you weren't allowed to cry or show emotions.
No, I wasn't allowed to feel, you know, and just like when my mom gave me the alcohol on, you know, when I was 6 months old, just to shut me up. Yeah. It's like, I'm not allowed to be anything other than happy, you know, and like definitely not feel emotions or sadness, like take it like a man, you know? Yeah. And so I learned how to do that, but I didn't know how to feel. And so when I surrendered to that pain in that cell that day, you know, it was 3 days of just crying and bawling my eyes out and like just feeling the pain. Yeah. Normally it's like all the reasons why I shouldn't be feeling this way, all the reasons why it's somebody else's fault, you know, what that must mean about me, as a result of these feelings, right?
Yeah.
But in that moment when I said, fine, I'll just feel it, I just felt it. And
so just decades of fucking of pain and trauma all just bam.
Yeah.
Right there.
Yeah. You know, and on the other side of that pain, 3 days later, it was like I had this image of this eye of the storm. You know, it's like there was finally this eye of freedom and peace, you know, in the middle of the storm that I was in. And I left there, and I don't know how, because this definitely wasn't of me, you know. Yeah. It's like I can't explain it, but I can say that in that moment, I knew that there was a purpose for me, and I knew that there was a purpose for everything that I had been through, you know. Uh-huh. And I was willing to do life if that's where I was supposed to be. And I don't know where that came from, you know. I call it God, you know, but like that, it definitely wasn't me. It wasn't my mentality. It wasn't who I had trained to be my entire life, you know, but in that moment, that's how I felt. And I became willing to do life in prison, you know, and in that moment, I also knew that I wasn't going to do life in prison. It's like, once I surrendered, I realized that's why I was there. I was supposed to be there to surrender. And, and I went to court, and I had like all these inspirations, we'll say, you know, because of being in that state of surrender. And I would tell the attorney, and, you know, and anyway, long story short, you know, I ended up switching attorneys.
Okay.
Or it got switched for me. Okay. That attorney did everything that I asked. And I obviously I didn't get life because I'm sitting here right now, you know, and I got to be out another 30 days and go get my husband and deal with his ashes and settle that before I had to turn myself in on my case.
Okay.
And I ended up having to do 8 years, 8 months.
8 years in prison, 8 months.
Yeah. And, well, I actually, that's not true. I got 8 years, 8 months, and I ended up doing a little over 6 years.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Not like it's that much of a difference, but yes.
Right.
You got six.
I got 6 years,
and then you have stayed clean and sober since that amazing
So I experience. Wish I could say that I stayed sober that long, you know. That's not what happened. You know, what happened for me was I started off, so with that like spiritual awakening that I had in that cell that day, right? I was in like the state of surrender, and they ended up putting me in solitary confinement for the first couple years of my my stay. Yeah.
Oh shit.
Because of my neck. And so I had a hole in my spinal cord. So I didn't tell you that when I was in county jail, also I got another emergency surgery, you know, and they were telling me that I was going paralyzed from the neck down, and there was nothing I could do about it, you know,
dude.
And if I get in a fight that,
it's
you know,
done. It's over.
Yeah. So they were keeping me in solitary confinement in the skilled nursing facility. And so I was there alone for the first couple years, and I just, did a lot of, I lived kind of like a monk in there, you know?
Yeah, I could see that.
And on purpose, I did a lot of self-reflection. I learned mindfulness. I did, you know, I studied religions and, you know, and there's a lot more. I don't want to get into all
but what I can
say is that time for me, I said, you know what, this was it. I thought it was the solution, and I could stay clean through these practices and like this. When they let me out to general population, you know, all the worldly stuff started to come back. And and so, yeah. So anyway, long story short, I ended up getting loaded again in there.
Okay.
And I ended up putting myself into treatment while I was in there, because I realized that I am an addict and I'm somebody that needs 12-step.
Yes.
You know, I can't do it all on my own.
Uh-huh.
And so so I ended up putting myself in treatment there, and I got out with 6 months clean is what happened. And so
it's a good start.
Yeah. You know, and so in the past, it was like I got all these suggestions. You know, I heard all the suggestions from being around the rooms for so many years.
Yeah.
And it was always about like, oh, yeah, that's good for you, not for me. And I picked and choose what was going to what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And this time I just said, OK, you know what? Screw it. I'm tired. And I don't want to keep doing this anymore. Excuse me.
That's
and
okay.
So I became willing to, you know, take all the suggestions.
Yeah.
So I took them all.
Yeah.
I took them all and stay out of a relationship for the first year. You know, go to 90 meetings, 90 days. I went to like 120.
Nice.
Got service commitments, mm-hmm. you know, got a sponsor, started working my steps, all that stuff. Got really gut level honest for the first time.
Yeah.
You know, and I got to tell you, you know, when I started this round, you know, of coming in, I thought that still, because I have this disease mind, even though this took me out before, I still thought, okay, so I'm going to do this for a year, 100%. And then at the end of the year, I'll be able to be normal.
You'll graduate.
I thought, you know, I'll be able to be normal integrate into real world.
I do that recovery thing for a year and then I'm good.
Right. You know, just give it 100%, you know? And, so I gave it 100% though in that first year. And what happened for me was I realized that normal people don't plan for the day that they could drink again.
That is kind of true,
right?
Yeah.
You know, normal people don't do that, and so I'm not normal. And also, you know, as a result of it, I ended up getting so much freedom. I got all of the freedom that this program talks about, and that, you know, inside, where I started to develop self love. You know, and the hardest thing for me to give up was the men.
Yeah,
I'm gonna be honest, because that was my first addiction, because that was the only place I knew how to feel valued, or that I mattered, or that I loved. Like, I was taught that from an early age. I had a lot of sexual abuse, you know, and that's the only thing I ever felt valuable. That's what everybody wanted me for, whether they took it or I gave it, you know, mm-hmm. that's what they wanted me for. So so for me to give that up, you know, was the hardest thing I ever walked through, you know, and the best thing that I ever walked through.
Right.
Because at the end of the year, you know, all those times where it's like I wanted to reach out for validation, but I gave it to myself, you know, and I did acts of self-love, you know, it allowed self-love to grow.
Yeah.
And I began to feel what it feels like to be whole, you know, and recovery for me. And obviously, so at the end of that year, I didn't want to give up anything that I've gained. I had gained so much of the freedom that it talked about it here, that there was nothing that could pull me away from this life,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I just wanted more of that, you know? And so I'm on fire for that now, you know? So that first year though, let me tell you, you know, like it was hard and grueling, and it was the best thing that I ever did. And then I just continue that, you know. So I use all the mindfulness practices. I use the meditation and the self-reflection and mindfulness. And I get to teach that now, you know, because that's a huge part of it for me. Like I hit that fourth step before and I didn't know how to deal with emotions. Like, and people in rooms didn't know how to tell me how to deal with emotions. Just sit with it. Just feel it. Yeah. Okay. How do you do that? You know, I had no idea how to do that. And I couldn't get the kind of direction. So I found that, you know, elsewhere. Sometimes we have to do that, you know?
Yeah, sometimes.
So in order for me to be able to get deep into my steps, you know, I had to find other tools and direction to help me do that, you know? And I found that. So I use it all. And, you know, and as a result of that, you know, it's like I get the benefits of all of it. And, you know, today I want to say, you know, so I have, no fronts, but in a month and a couple days, I will have 9 years.
Here.
No fronts, but thank you.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, recovery has been such a beautiful and messy journey. You know, it's like one of the things that I learned from that jail cell that day was to lean into my pain, you know, without all the reasons why I shouldn't be feeling this way or why it's somebody else's fault. What I didn't realize was that at the time is like whatever we resist persists, right?
Yeah.
So like when we're fighting life or fighting these emotions, we make it stronger.
Mm-hmm.
We make them stronger. And I was just making it stronger, which is why I kept getting, I call them God smacks. It's like I'm fighting life, you know, and I'm keep getting smacked, you know, and they're getting so big until I'm getting knocked out, you know? And today I know that like, that's what's going to happen if I resist whatever's coming up in life, you know? So
yes,
I'm still a big fan of instant gratification. I have that from my disease. Like we want it now.
Yeah.
And that's a transferable skill that I get to use towards my recovery. you know? And now I know that like when I go towards the stuff and I lean into the hard stuff and I lean into the pain without all the stories about it, you know, I just feel whatever my relationship to the experience, what's my side of the street, what's coming up for me. And I feel that authentically and fully, it dissolves.
It does.
It dissolves and it heals. And then I no longer have to live with it. It no longer controls me. You know, I used to live through this filter of like pain, and all my actions came from that. All of my reaching outward, looking for, you know, to be filled, and it just put a Band-Aid on it of this big gaping, bleeding, gashing wound, you know, it doesn't work. Yeah. And so like, this is the only way that I've found to heal that, you know, and, I lean into it and I keep doing it, you know, and I keep getting deeper and deeper freedom through that. Yeah. And I'm so grateful, you know, there's been, you know, every time it's and that's another thing, grateful, right?
Yeah, that's, gratitude.
That's huge for me. Like, like finding what I can be grateful for in the middle of the mess. You know, sitting in prison, it's like I was in there and I was getting a lot of growth during that period. And and I would look around and I would see, like when I went to the main yard, you know, and it's like I would look around and I would see all this misery and everybody's complaining all the time. Like it's just, you know, that area, you know, that it's that's what you feel. That's what it is there. You know, it's a lot of everybody's miserable. Right. Yeah. And I found peace there. Like I found, you know, peace and that's kind of served me well, is like to be able to find what I'm grateful for in the middle of the crap, you know? And so I use that tool in my recovery today. And sometimes the only thing I could find to be grateful for is, well, I'm about to level up, you know, because I know on the other side of it is that freedom.
Yeah.
And so, but gratitude is like huge, you know, it plays a big part in recovery, you know, and gratitude is the cure for anxiety. And, you know.
Yeah, you're right.
And yeah, so
I'm not trying to control everything and try to accept things and be grateful.
Yeah, you know, and so yeah, so you know, I have I've worked a few round of steps and and this last year, so I kind of came because I had that spiritual awakening before I came into recovery.
Yeah.
Right. I never really and I did it like my ass depended on it this time, you know.
Yeah.
I did recovery full force,
yeah,
like the whole time, because I've done all the other ways and none of them worked. So this time I did full force, and I've never taken a break from that, because I don't want to let go of any of the tools that have kept me clean, because I don't know which one of them are keeping me clean. So I do them all, you know.
Right.
I just continue to do them all and balance, you know.
Just find the one that works at the time and go with it.
Yeah. So as a result of that, you know, I've had joy, you know, and there's been like, I've lost my father, you know, so I got out and I was able to, help take care of my father the last couple of years of his life.
Oh, really?
And I got to heal a lot of the core issues that I had when we were, you know, from our past. Like, remember, he was my nemesis. And
yes.
So getting to leave nothing left unsaid, you know, after dealing with, you know, my husband's death and not being able to tell him all those things that I wish I would have, I knew, you know, so I got to use that to help me through the death of my father and make sure that I left nothing left unsaid, you know, and we healed that dynamic, you know, and as a result of that, you know, he stopped treating me that way.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't change, but I changed. And so, and as a result of that, our relationship changed.
Right.
You know, and when he died, you know, I was able to hold his hand, you know, while he died, and like, and through that process, and, you know, it's like, I only have gratitude, and I was able to set him free with like, with love, you know, and my mom, you know, I got to move in with my mom and you know, help take care of my dad. And it turns out, you know, she has become my best friend. And when I was young and I used to wish for this mom that, I had really low expectations back then, you know, and now we have this relationship that I never even knew that I could have, you know.
Yes.
She's my best friend, and we get to be on this recovery journey together, which I'm so grateful for, you know, and we work together to too, and, you know, in our field that we work in. And you know, when we get to travel the world together, we get to do all the things. And, and you know, through this this path, like this process with my mom, you know, I realized, you know, I've done a lot of healing and I continue to do a lot of healing in that area for all the core issues that, you know, I had when I was young. Mm-hmm. I realized that, like, you know, I still have the, had this belief in me that, like, if she would just da-da-da, I would feel loved, you know? Why can't she just, you know, ask me what happened? Or why can't she just say, I'm so sorry for everything you've been through? Why can't, you know what I mean? Because that's that's how I'll feel loved then. And what I realized is that she, even if I got that from her, I wouldn't be able to feel it. I have to be the one that heals it. You know, because I have gotten that from her, but there's still that, there was still that empty hole and like, and still that, like this place where I didn't have the receptors for it to come from outside of me at all. You know, and so I had to, I had to heal that stuff. I continue to heal that stuff, and it keeps getting deeper and deeper. And you know, and I get to release her from that too, because she is an amazing woman, and she's done so much in her own recovery, and she's doing exactly what she what she can. You know, and it's a lot, and I'm really grateful for her. Like, she's amazing. Our relationship is amazing, and she. What I realized also from working the steps is like they've done the best they can with what they knew at the time, just like I did. And so, you know, I'm really grateful. And you know, so I heal my own receptors now. You know, I know that it can't come from her. It can't come from anywhere outside of me. It
comes within you.
It's, it's within me, you know. And and as a result of that, you know, our relationship has skyrocketed. You know, and I can say that, like, you know, today it's like I get to, you know, amends. The amends process is so amazing. Like, we get so scared of making amends our first round. It's like, gosh, I have to take responsibility for this stuff.
I struggle. I struggle with that too.
Okay, so that's one of my favorite steps now, because the amends process just becomes so beautiful, you know, and so integrated in, and it feels like just so, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, it talks about doing esteemable acts, right? And like, and how that really helps to make us whole, you know, and fill that void. You know, it's not about anything outside of us. It's like, it's about us. Like, integrity is what you're doing when nobody's looking, right? And that stuff. So like, you know, my amends has morphed, you know, through the years, you know, and, started off as the surface stuff, but like, you know, even like, you know, with my husband, you know, even with, you know, remember I told you about, you know, when I was bullied when I was young and I set out to beat up every girl and I became the bully, right? I became the bully and like I got to, and I, you know, I got, you know, we'll call it victimized, right? I got victimized a lot by, you know, by the, by men, you know? And so I really held, I thought I hated women because of all the trauma that I had from women. So I never really let myself get close to women after, that, when I snapped that day in junior high school, it's like, no, I kept them at an arm's distance and I was mean to women first so that they would stay away from me, you know, and the only ones I hung out with were the ones that were like me, and we would go hang out with fellas, but we didn't talk about girl stuff. We didn't talk about, you know, I didn't know how to have those kinds of conversations with women. And, you know, with men, the only value that I felt was, you know, how hot I could be and how much they wanted me, you know? And so, but cutting all that off and giving it to myself is like, it, you know, it's like all this new stuff started to emerge. And so, you know, recovery taught me in that first year, right, to not hang out with the men, to hang out with the women and all that stuff they say. And I never caught that before and I never did that before. This time when I told you I took all the suggestions and so I would put myself around women and it was so awkward, especially especially when I took away my coping skill of being violent or mean or a bitch. You know, It's like taking that away. That was my only protection. All of a sudden I'm vulnerable. I feel really awkward. Not only do I have nothing to contribute to this conversation because I don't know how to talk like a girl, you know,
I also, like a nice girl,
like a nice girl. Right. And I didn't know how to talk like a nice girl, you know, like a girly girl. And I didn't know how to, I didn't know how to be vulnerable, but I would put myself in the middle of it. Remember I said leaning into pain, right?
Yeah.
So like, that's been my theme and throughout my recovery is like, okay, going towards the things that are uncomfortable because I'm a fan of instant gratification. And I know if I don't lean into it, I'm going to make it stronger. So whatever we resist persists. I don't want to do that. So I'm not going to resist it. So I go towards that shit on purpose, you know? And I put myself in the middle of conversations feeling so awkward and I would just breathe. I would just breathe and I'd hear people talking about boys and the stuff and like, and I didn't ever have those conversations. And my head would tell me I have nothing to contribute to this conversation, but I would just sit there and I kept putting myself in the awkward situations till, you know, I started to relax and get comfortable and I started to feel different. It started to change, you know? You know, and so as a result of that, you know, I realized, man, you know, and also like in working my steps, I realized and going through all of the pain that I caused women because I victimized women.
Yeah.
You know, I ran a strip club, you know, and I wanted what I could get out of them, you know.
Yeah.
And so I victimized women and I was mean to women.
Yeah. It's a business where it's like, you know, you have to kind of, you know, like have standards, I guess.
Well, maybe you know, like, you think of them as your business, right? But,
yes.
But I think for me, it was more than that. You know, for me, it was all the years of pain and that, you know, that, and not respecting myself.
Yeah.
That I didn't respect women.
Yes.
You know, and so I victimized them. And so as a result of like working my steps and doing this amends process, you know, it's like that's why today, like I am the first one to go up to a newcomer and like, and make sure they feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want everyone to know they're safe, that I feel their pain. Like, and so women to me today are the most important thing, you know, and like, not that men aren't, you know, men are important, but I mean, for me, like that's why I always want a woman to feel safe in my presence. I want them to know that I can meet them at their pain. And I get it, you know, it's part of my amends process to do that. And that's what feels like, it's that esteemable act, but it's like, it fills that hole in me. I heal when I do get to do that, you know, and that's part of my living amends. Mm-hmm. It's part of my living amends to, you know, like you were going to ask me about Dollface Club.
Yes, I was.
Yeah. So that's a huge part of that. So it's another part of that spinoff is like, you know, all the popular girls and stuff, like I did not get along with them. I beat them all up when I was really young, you know, because I didn't fit in and because I was bullied, you know? And so like when I never felt like I fit in. So for me, like Dollface Club was a way of like making friends with the parts of myself that I've rejected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and being there for others. What Dollface Club represents is a strong sisterhood of women being supportive of each other, you know, and giving back to the community, you know, in various ways and like, but together. And it's like, so for me, it's like, you know, saying, come on, let's do this together. Like you're a part of, because I never felt a part of, you know, so like getting to, no matter who you are, if you're a woman, you know, they say in our program, right? You remember when you say you are? Same with Dollface Club. Like people ask all the time, how do I become a member? Yeah, you show up, you know?
Oh, you don't get jumped in?
You don't get jumped in. You show up, you say, I want to do service, and you come do it. You know, you want to come hang out? You come hang out. Like, if you feel awkward, I get it. So come hang out with me and tell me you feel awkward because I will make sure that, you know, that I meet you there, you know? And like, we could do this together because I felt awkward and I knew what that was like, you know? And so, you know, for me, it's like, it's been part of my healing journey, you know, to be a part of this and using all those skills that I got, that I had while I was out there, like, you know, putting on events for strip clubs and all of that. Like I get to do that now for Dollface Club. These are all transferable skills that we get to use in our life, you know? And there's a reason why, you know, we have been on our journeys. Like we get to use all that stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, Dollface Club is really a beautiful you know, movement.
Yeah.
And
I it's funny because you were saying about I totally see it, like, because I remember I had my own event, and you know, I don't know how to fucking throw anything together, man. I'm such an introverted fucking human fucking being. I was introverted way before it was cool, and fucking Sage, you know, actually really helped me out and guided me throwing that 1 year party. And I, you know, hearing your story, I totally like put all the pieces together, and like how you had, you know, all these skills, you know, while you're in your addiction, and you're using it for service, and you're using it for like awareness and recovery. And it's such a beautiful thing, which you have been able to accomplish. And I also just, you know, it's like just a personal thing, you know, I've just always felt like you're the most like welcoming person I've ever, you know, in the rooms. Cause you know, sometimes people can be, you know, a little standoffish or a little shrug, but you know, Sage will always like, you know what I mean? Like just like you have like that energy, you know what I mean? Like you just want to light the room almost. And it's really awesome.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
That means a lot to me, you know, because I probably was the one that was the most standoffish and the most violent, you know.
Yeah.
I learned at an early age that, you know, the more crazier I could be, the more violent I could be, the more I was protected.
Right.
You know, and so I set off to do that. So, you know, I have to do the opposite in my recovery. Right. And so for today, I want everyone to feel safe around me. And I want everyone to know that I get it. You know, I want everyone to feel welcome. And so that means a lot to me.
Yeah.
And so thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Mm. Is there, I know that you, so you are throwing events and stuff like that for Dollface Club. Is there anything that's coming up? Any sort of projects or any sort of thing that you're in the works of?
Well, yeah, for Dollface Club, we have an event usually every month. We try and get one in every month.
Yeah.
You know, our next one, we're going into, you know, a homeless shelter. I don't know if we're allowed to say names on here. A homeless shelter.
I don't care, but yeah.
Yeah. We're going into a homeless shelter where they have, you know, families, and so we get to do makeovers with the families and the kids and bring in, you know, donations. We do different stuff. Depending on the need, wherever we're called, we just kind of go because Lord knows we've taken enough from our community when we were all getting loaded. So this is our way of doing service and giving back to society, you know, and making a positive impact rather than a negative one, you know, and we get to do this together. We get to be this strong sisterhood of women and be there for each other, you know, and none of us are perfect, but together we are as a whole, you know. We are. And so I love doing this work. I love Clea that she started this work and getting closer to her over the years. It's like she's one of my best friends now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and she called me up one day and she's like, I have this idea, you know, I want to do a documentary for like, we've been losing, you know, like everybody from fentanyl, as you know, it's like it's left and right. I lost a sponsee. We're losing people. Like it's painful. It's tragic. And I can see, I get it because my husband died.
Yeah.
And it's the most painful thing that someone can go through, you know?
It is.
And like for that area, you know, it's like, you know, I've got to, so she called me one day and she's like, I want to do a documentary, you know, on this fentanyl overdose epidemic. And I was like, yes, like everything in me was like, yes, let's do this. We need to bring awareness. Cause at that time, nobody was seeing, like everybody still judged the fentanyl, like for like, okay, the junkie, it's the junkies that are dying, you know,
of course.
Not that there's anything wrong with junkies. Cause I'm a junkie. Do you know what I mean?
I am too.
But society in general, like we need to bring awareness to this. Like it isn't just the junkies anymore, you know? And not that's any less, but like it's also, it's affecting, and they're not even using needles anymore, you know?
Oh, no.
It's like this stuff is on everything, you know? And it's killing everyone from, you know, from the kid that's still in junior high school, you know, to the, you know, I just lost the friend that I first did heroin with, you know, and she was like, I don't know, 60 or something, you know? Yeah. And like, so it's affecting all walks of life, every area, you know? And, and it's important that we bring awareness to this to our society, because it can affect you, your family, your kids. Yeah. You know, they're one time, they're using one time and they're dying. It's not like you're going out and getting an addiction. Like when we were young, we used to be able to experiment. You know, you can't do that now.
No, not you know, at all.
It's on everything. It's on the weed. It's in the pills. It's like, and it's killing them. So, you know, absolutely. So everything in me said yes. And like, as I'm doing this with her, we have this nonprofit now called Nobody Plans on Dying that we also pulled in another friend of ours, Layla, and like, and us three together, we started this nonprofit called Nobody Plans on Dying, you know?
That's
and
so awesome.
And our plan is to complete this documentary that we've been working on and get it into the schools and get to go speak with all the schools and possibly Netflix and all this stuff. We have we have the ins for all of it. And so, you know, fingers crossed, and we'll see we'll see what happens. But, you know, I know that I'm not in control. Like, this is a higher power situation. Yeah. But I can say that every little bit of it, it's like I get to talk to my husband, you know, and like, and I know that like, it's like, this is part of my amends, you know, this is part of my amends. Like, I couldn't help him, you know, but I can help others. Yeah. And, you know, it's part of my living amends. So it's, it means so much to me to be able to be a part of this movement, you know, cause it's what it is. It's a movement, you know?
Absolutely.
So, you know, getting to do that, you know, I got to also, I've been working in treatment for, you know, for many years and like, and getting to help in that way. And again, you know, like it's part of my living amends, you know, and that's not my primary job anymore. Like now I moved over more towards like, the other realm that helps me, right?
Okay.
For my own, to give that part, you know, and that it's like, I get to live a purpose-driven life today,
right?
You know, and I'm really freaking grateful. Like I feel, I have no idea where I'm going. All I know is that, you know, that I keep doing the next indicated thing. Like throughout recovery, there's a couple things, right? One, recovery has been a process of becoming unapologetically, authentically myself. You know, I had no idea who I am. And some days I still don't know, but I just live in truth to the best of my ability. And that's my authentic self. You know, and like, and you get deeper and deeper and deeper until you are just this being, you know, that's like, that's like living in purpose and doing the next indicated thing, you know? And so I go where I'm called and wherever I feel inspired to go now, you know, and that's kind of how I live my life. And it hasn't turned me wrong. Like everything that's happened that's good in my life has been a result of doing service.
Yeah.
Like everything, like, even working in treatment, it was like I was doing service and I was invited and you know, and, you know, to backtrack a little bit, like even, you know, my, me going paralyzed, right? Yeah. I touched on that a little bit. They told me that there's nothing I can do about it. I'm going paralyzed. I want to let you know that, you know, I had three surgeons tell me that there's nothing I can do, that I'm going paralyzed because I'm leaking spinal fluid. And they told me I shouldn't exercise. And they told me, they told me, because I leak spinal fluid, if I strain my neck and all this stuff, you know, that they told me. And, you know, I won't go through the whole story of that. If you want to know, you could ask me later, but, but I will say that I have just allowed, you know, my higher power to guide me in that.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't hold anything as absolute. Like they said that, okay, great, but they're not the ultimate decider here. You know, like, you know, I'm just gonna. My body will tell me what I can and can't do, and my higher power will show me what I can and can't do. You know, and like that's kind of like that's how I lived, and that's how it's helped me throughout my recovery to navigate.
Uh-huh.
And as a result of that, you know, I did start exercising and I realized that, you know, my body felt better when I exercised. Started to get circulation. I had a walker. I had a walker. God, I looked like, you know, really? And like, yes, really.
I'm laughing because Sage is in, she looks like she's in very good shape.
So it's crazy. I'm a personal trainer now.
Yeah. And I was about to mention that.
Yeah, like, you know, Exactly. And
you went from like someone that probably never going to walk again.
Yeah.
And been diagnosed as crippled for life by three professional people.
On paper, I still am.
To like extremely like fit. And not only that, a personal trainer.
Yeah.
Helping other people get fit.
Yeah. I realize a lot of the limitations that we put on ourselves are in our mind. And if we believe what they say, then I would have stuck with that.
Absolutely.
But because I didn't, you know, it's like I hold it. Don't get me wrong. I hold it in my consciousness. And I know I'm not invincible.
Of course.
You know, it has humbled me quite a bit because I was this extreme sports person before. And I can't. Some things I can't do. I have some limitations now.
Okay.
But like I've allowed myself to surrender into those limitations. It's been, you know, it was a painful process. There was, you know, I had to go through all the things you think someone might go through from that. Yeah, like getting told they're going paralyzed from the neck down. My husband's dead. Who's going to take care of me? Who's going to wipe my ass? Like, oh my God, like all that stuff, you know?
Oh my God, that's so fucking awesome.
You know, but like all that stuff you would expect. But like as a result of that and like surrendering to even that, you know, it's like here I am and I sit in front of you and every year I go get an MRI so they can take a look. And,
of course.
There's no degeneration and they cannot explain it. I had three different surgeons tell me that I was going paralyzed from the neck down and there was nothing I could do about it. I wanted three different opinions because I didn't... You know, and like, and today I go to the doctor and I get an MRI. I have no idea what the future is going to be later, but I can say that, you know, it's been many years. That was since 2010.
Okay.
And so every year I go to the doctor, I get a new MRI, and every year there's no degeneration and they can't explain it.
Right.
You know, according to them, I wasn't even supposed to exercise. And so, of course, I became a personal trainer.
That's a really cool fuck you.
Well, I just realized, you know, the limitations are the limitations that we put on our mind and we all have our own struggles. And so and again, it was like I was doing it in service to help others. And as a result, I became a personal trainer. Like everything that I do in life had to do with me doing it for myself first, then being in service to others.
Yeah.
And then it became a career, you know, it became part of my story and my career and where I'm going. Like I just go where I'm led. And first I heal me, then I help others, and then it takes me to do that even more and expand it. And like so that's kind of what I do. That's how my life is going. I have no idea what's gonna happen in the future, you know. I can say that, you know, that I completed school like several times in different areas and I'm still in the process of completing a couple different things, you know, and like, and I'm going after my dreams and, and you know, sometimes I have no idea how I'm even working with some of the people that I work with in this world because they are world changers in this planet. And I think of, wow, you know, I'm just this person who, you know, grew up the way I grew up, you know, and like, and I was destined for that lifestyle and like, and I don't know how I'm sitting here in, you know, with these people, you know, getting to do this amazing work into this world. Like I have, you know, I don't know. And I don't, it's not for me to know, but I just go where I'm led. Yeah. So, you know, I just, you know, we'll see as the story unfolds, but it's really exciting.
Oh, it's so really awesome. Exciting. It's so fucking awesome.
Life is exciting today.
Fuck yeah. Like I said, I mean, I totally, I respect your hustle. But more importantly, like, you know, you just touched on like, you know, it all just kind of everything that you have done from when you first got clean or, you know, whatever, you started your recovery journey this time around to right now. It's all because of service. And it's something that it resonates with me as well, you know, because I definitely like, you know, did my fair share of being a menace to society. And I did my fair share of being part of the problem. And I just want to be a better person, you know. I don't want to just not use drugs and all that and just try to be normal. I want to you know just give back, man. But this gift I've been given, man, because I could have, you know, fucked off and died 1,000 fucking times, and here I am alive and shit and I get to, you know, work in treatment and I get to, you know, raise awareness and all that stuff. And it's just, it's, I just relate a lot. It's not something I ever saw coming. It's just fucking came, and I'm keep going.
Yes.
And I really appreciate you sharing your story, and you know, I just feel like I could relate so much to it, and I really appreciate you coming on here again. You're a fucking amazing fucking woman in recovery, and I really appreciate everything you do again. You know what I mean? Like, you know, if anybody can get anything out of it, it's like, you know, fucking recovery is fucking possible.
It's possible. And not even just that, man. Everything that I've always been searching for, right? Everything that I was always searching for outside of myself, I found in myself through this program.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it, not just in myself, that's in my higher power, but like,
yes,
but like, it's all here. It's all within me,
yes,
you know? And so I just want to say that, you know, like, it's it. Just come find yourself. It's here. This is a program of becoming unapologetically, authentically you. We need you in this world. We don't need, you know,
the surface.
We don't need the surface. We don't need any more of that. You know, we need you authentically, authentic you, you know? So.
Absolutely. Thank you again for coming on, Sage. I really appreciate it. All right.
Thank you.
Goodbye, everybody.